Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting across from Jimmy Barnes again because he's come out with volume two of his memoir, Working Class Man. Thank you for joining us, Jimmy.
Yeah, I know. Thanks, mate. Thanks for having us here.
It is it is the book of Christmas for us. It is going to be one of the biggest books of the year. We expect it to be the number one. Number one's a place you're used to, I think. Is that what you're aiming for? Like, I've done number one in the record industry, now I'm going to do number one.
It was funny, I made jokes about it. When I first signed with HarperCollins, I said, oh, you know, how many books is a big book? And they sort of, well, I don't know, 20,000 or something. I said, well, I want to do a lot more than that. You know, I used to be number one. But I was actually joking. But in light of writing this book, you know, I talk about it in the book. You know, part of the thing of my whole career I've measured my own self-worth by other people's sort of view of me. So if I got a number one record, I thought it was worth something. So I guess, you know, it's part of the unhealthy side of my personality.
And we got to spend a bit of time with you last year signing books. And this year you seem a little up, a little more, like, it was the process of getting book one out of your system, did it actually do stuff for you?
I think it was certainly cathartic. I mean, the process, I think I mentioned last year, the process of writing it was a weight lifted off my shoulders anyway. And then, you know, I got to spend five, six months touring, promoting, and then doing the Working Class Boys shows, where it was sort of like the show every night was like going through and reanalyzing what I'd written and rethinking it and remembering more of it. So I think the whole process was enlightening, you know. And I mean that in the literal sense of the word. I felt a lot like I'd got a lot off my chest and a lot off my back as well, you know. And I just felt like I was, you know, I could start to move forward. And of course, that led me to writing this book. And at the same time, this was a whole new set of, you know, in the first book, I had all this this stuff, you know, where it was childhood stuff, and it was a lot of stuff was out of my control, a lot of, you know, it was a lot of pain and trauma and all that sort of stuff, but it was out of my control, and I could sort of, you know, blame my family and my parents and all that sort of stuff. But with this book, it's a whole new set of stuff, because really, no matter how much I relate that, you know, the way I am to my childhood, once you become an adult, really, you've got to sort of stand up and cop it on the chin and say, this is my decision. So this was a whole new set of, you know, the writing process, and this was a whole new set of pressure and a whole new sort of set of, you know, self-evaluation and all that sort of stuff.
They could have had the subtitles Cause and Effect.
Yes, but, well, really, you know, I'm not going to sort of sit and blame my behavior as an adult on me as a kid, but part of the process and part of the reason for writing this book, really, because Working Class Boy, I realized connected with so many people, because so many people went through similar things. So many people live with violence and poverty and abuse and all that stuff that goes on, you know, that went on in my life. And they related to it, and I wanted to talk about the knock-on effects of a childhood like that, and how it affects a person as an adult. And the thing is, that affected me as an adult, and really I had everything at my feet. I had the world at my feet. I, you know, made a lot of money. I was popular. I could do anything I wanted. But even then, it's this trauma as a child nearly killed me as an adult. So you know, you think about people right there who don't have the luxury of having, you know, being able to scream at people every night on stage or have money to deal with these issues. You know, there's a lot of people out there who went through the same trauma as me, who are living, struggling to make ends meet now. And so I wanted to write this book about that, the effects of that knocking on people, so that, you know, so that it's, once again, it starts a conversation about the effects of poverty, really.
Well, last night on Q&A, you were talking about the opening of the book, which is quite stark. And it, as far as I can tell, it's quite recent history. It's not
it's 2012.
That's insane. So the way it opens up is that you've come back from a gig. You're with your wife.
Yeah.
You're both drinking, taking lots of different drugs, and then you go to bed, but you can't go to sleep. And then you just keep taking everything you can take.
Well, yeah, but the thing was, by that point it was sort of a culmination of, it wasn't just like a bender, it'd been a bender that had been going on for years, you know. Just I from the time I left home as a kid, I ran away from my childhood, and for a while I ran away just by getting away and playing rock and roll, and then I found I had to drink, so I didn't think about my childhood. Then I started taking drugs, so I didn't think about my childhood. Then no matter how much I drank, it kept coming back to me. So I literally, for years, just stayed permanently, in a state of, out of it.
But so, to me, it's astonishing. 2012 is such a short period of time ago, and yeah. The things that you've been able to accomplish in that state, there's changes in your career, in the way you're doing music, all these things were going on,
yeah,
and in the background you're living this sort of double life thing.
Yeah, it was, but it's that thing about, people who are struggling quite often overachieve, it's like smoke and mirrors. I was making everybody, doing all this to make myself feel worthy at all. So, and that made me really driven. I had to be successful. I couldn't, be a failure, because it would have meant I was, it would have been not only a failure in my eyes, but I thought in everybody else's eyes too. So as long as I had people liking me, even though I was falling apart on my side, it kept me up. But eventually it got to the point where, even though I was, having number one records and, singing at the Olympics and doing all this stuff, it didn't make any difference. I was rapidly being faced with my own, my own problems that I couldn't hide from anymore.
I was, it struck me the other day, because I was young when you left Cold Chisel, but it was a big thing, mm-hmm. you leaving Cold Chisel, yeah. for Australian culture. And then coming out with your solo albums. I had no idea, because being young, I look up and see this old mm-hmm. bloke on the stand singing away. You're 26 when that when that happened. That's very young.
Yeah, I joined at 17.
So that whole period of doing all the touring and the going around with Cold Chisel and doing all the hardest pubs in Australia.
Was over by the time I was 27.
Wow.
and then literally, at that point, I remember, because I joined Cold Chisel at 16 and 16 and a half, and I thought to myself, I remember thinking, I don't want to be 21. That's really old. Look at these old bastards at 21. Yeah. So I just went hard, and I thought, I don't care if I don't make it 21. And eventually I got to 21, and I thought, it's not that old. Maybe I'll stick around at 25. And by the time I was 25, we started, I met Jane, my wife, and we started thinking about a family. So at 27 years old, I had a child, and I was precariously balanced on the edge of the collapse of Cold Chisel, and trying to work out how I was going to take this forward. And basically, that battle, led me through, I was trying so hard to compensate for what I thought were my own failures, that I went on, had 7 number one albums in a row,
mind blowing.
And really, it's not like I just did this on my own. I have an uncanny knack of surrounding myself with really good people. I mean, I was lucky enough dear friends in my bands, and I had incredible friends and allies in Mushroom Records. Michael Gadinsky is another guy who's fought in tooth and nail to be successful, and fights continually. And he was right on my side, so we were sort of a team. So even when I would start to flag and fall down, somebody else would pick up the slack. So I've been lucky. I've surrounded myself with good people.
So you've done everything you possibly can to kind of undermine this drive that's just imagine if in a parallel universe that your father was an alcoholic and the father's father was an alcoholic and didn't come out, what you might have done. I mean, because it is a kind
frightening.
Of
frightening.
Yeah,
but also I don't know if I would have done any of this, because part of what drove me was that I didn't feel good enough.
So running.
That was trying to prove something to myself was because of where I came from. Maybe if I didn't have that, I wouldn't have been as driven. But at the same time, I wouldn't have been undermining myself at the same time.
Jimmy, we have to wrap this up because you have to fly. I'd love to talk to you for hours and hours, but I have the book to read. So I
read the book and we'll come back.
Yeah, I'll come back. Yeah.
We'll do that. All right.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, mate.
And you can get Jimmy's Working Class Man and Working Class Boy at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.